Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, March 27th. Be prepared. This morning, we consider how those two words translate to evacuations in the event of a disaster, particularly when kupuna are involved. We take a moment to reflect on the history of homesteading in the islands, how the effort to help Native Hawaiians with housing got its start as we come off the Prince Kuhio holiday. We take a peek back in our archives at a TV series that featured a tenless hideaway. By Design was in production for its new season, and the shows honoring some of the best architecture have kicked off. And animated film shorts are always a kick in the pants. This time, a film festival from Lahaina, Maui goes on the road. A real treat for us here in Honolulu. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Evacuations in the event of a disaster are a concern for the general public, but as we learned from the Maui wildfires, they are extra worrisome for kupuna, who may not be as mobile as most folks. Here to talk about that is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so seniors, you know, are very vulnerable during disasters. You know, when we look at what happened in Lahaina, 70% of those who died in those fires were over 60 years old. And so now some seniors are trying to take it upon themselves to get involved in their communities, especially those in affordable senior housing, because unlike care facilities, they don't have to report to Department of Health, you know, specific evacuations or, you know, disaster guidelines, because they are just in independent housing. You know, they're just living amongst themselves in senior housing. You know, this past August, a fire broke out in the forest next to Kahuku Ho'oli Hale, an affordable housing community for seniors and those with disabilities. I went out there yesterday to talk with Evelyn Lane. She's 67 years old and has lived in the community for 15 years now.
I have these two little dogs. I go out to walk them. It's like 5 in the afternoon. I go out, nothing going on over here. I walked to the end of that chain link fence at the end of the church parking lot on the other side. And I turn around and I see flames and smoke coming up out of here, and the wind is blowing right over to my house. And I'm running down the street because I forgot my phone. Fire! Dragging my poor little dog. And by the time I got here, some of the other neighbors had seen it too. They had called, everybody called. My boyfriend was coming from the golf course. He'd seen the flames too. So it was another one of these dangerous situations for our community.
Yeah, scary.
Yeah. And, you know, Kahuku Ho'oli Hale, it's a 32 single story duplex homes. And she says that they don't have any evacuation plans that are like disseminated to everybody. But she's been through disasters before. You know, she lived in Oakland during the 1991 tunnel fire that killed 25 people. And that's why she completed community emergency response team training about 6 months ago. And now she's trying to encourage her neighbors to be more prepared and get the broader community to do more things to take care of seniors in the area. And, you know, she's going door to door and hosting meetings with neighbors and working closely with the different types of businesses in the area to try to get some type of, you know, more urgency when it comes to not just evacuations for fires, but also hurricane preparedness, or, you know, people who are dealing with living in extreme heat because there's no ACs inside these homes. And so she's kind of taken it upon herself. And she's not the only one. You know, there's Dottie Kelly Paddock, who organized Ho'ula's Resiliency Hub. And, you know, she saw the need for the hurricane replies. And so she kind of got her whole community together to create these hubs. And so seniors are kind of taking it upon themselves to work with people in their communities to protect themselves, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I know that that was a real focus, is, you know, creating these pods and neighbors who can help neighbors.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, AARP Hawaii wants emergency management and policymakers to consider seniors more in the disaster planning. Kaylee Lopez says that kupuna are twice as likely to pass away in a disaster, particularly if they're mobility impaired. And she says that AARP Hawaii is going to be rolling out a template for building managers of senior housing developments to help them come up with emergency plans.
We see high interest really in especially the management folks, because they're busy trying to work with the tenants, keep the water running, dealing with electricity, dealing with all kinds of issues. So we're going to offer training on how to use the template, how to work with their own residents in the creation of the plan, because that's a best practice.
And so AARP, you know, also does disaster preparedness workshops for Kupuna. So you can actually call, if you have a community center or something, you can call AARP Hawaii and they'll come and do disaster preparedness workshops with your group or your group of friends or whoever you would need to do that with. And they also have a toolkit on their website for community leaders to help consider seniors a little bit more in their disaster planning. And they also give grants to community members, for example, Dottie Kelly Paddock, the Ha'ula Resiliency Hub, got a grant from AARP to install Starlink out there so that, you know, in case of a big emergency and the power goes out and the cell service there is already pretty bad, they're able to contact each other and have, you know, communications on people who are, you know, a little bit more vulnerable than others.
Good idea.
Yeah. And so they're really just kind of trying to, you know, do what they need to do to protect themselves, essentially. And so the state legislature is also considering resolutions that would ask the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency to develop outreach programs to, you know, better inform Kupuna about emergency preparedness. Senator Brandon Elefante introduced the measure and he emphasized the issues for seniors in independent housing. And he introduced the measure because of the conversations and the programs he was a part of when he was on the Honolulu City Council.
For those that live in senior affordable housing, aside from their resident manager or operations manager for those type of facilities, you know, the question becomes how much do those managers know about preparedness? And if they do know, do they have a connection to local county agencies or at the state level, such as HAIIMA, that they can reference or look to a plan? So that's what the resolution hopes to accomplish, is to really come up with a strategic focus and direction on how to basically reach out specifically to these certain types of populations.
And Representative Corey Chun introduced the House resolution version of it, and he compared it to being on an airplane.
Some people just need more time to get settled. And so in a case of emergency where you may have only minutes, being able to have those preparations and to know what to do in those situations for folks is of the essence, can sometimes be the difference between life or death.
And, you know, HAIIMA didn't submit any testimony on either of these measures, but they told me that they do have the Hawaii Hazards Awareness and Resiliency Program, which does have some training to help identify vulnerabilities to protect seniors.
Well, you know, in what you talked about with the Ha'ula, right? I mean, that was one of the one of the handful of communities that just kind of stepped up and say, hey, you know, we're vulnerable. What can we do to connect our people and make sure that they can get out in the event of a disaster? And I know I've done studies before with Kailua. I think they formed, you know, their units just out of concern when we had that tsunami in Japan and they saw what happened, you know, so they're prepared. And then also Manoa. Manoa had the flooding back there like 20 years ago. And so they just said, yeah, we're vulnerable. We have lots of seniors in this area. So you hope that there's like a template then, so they're not just recreating the wheel.
Right, exactly. And I think too, especially, you know, for people who are out in Kahuku or Ha'ula, the access there is pretty limited. And those roads will flood often because of sea level rise. And I think it's really been difficult for them to feel connected and able to get in and out of where they live and also, you know, have a place to store all the supplies that they would need if they're like blocked in during a hurricane or they need to shelter in place. And I think that's why, you know, Dottie has been really integral in connecting everybody. Like she and Evelyn got into all of this because of, you know, Dottie's, you know, interest in this and the Ha'ula community kind of spearheading a lot of these initiatives and spreading kind of that knowledge to other areas, especially along the coastline, because, you know, they're kind of facing this more remote nature of where they live. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've got like that senior home, Patsipunalu, you know, folks that are on the coastline that are vulnerable. But I just remember in that effort to get the community resilient that they planted breadfruit trees, ulu trees,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they're really mindful of, hey, if the roads are closed, we can't get food in here, what can we get in our own backyard?
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah. It's being smart, I think.
Right, right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We have been talking to HWARE's Ashley Mizuo. You can look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Meredith Artley, President and CEO of Hawaii Public Radio. If you've been keeping up with the news, you've heard about threats facing public media. The good news is that HPR is strong today, with 94% of our revenues coming from listeners just like you. Keep us strong going forward by donating right now, today, at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Foreign travelers are thinking twice about visiting the U.S., like these folks from north of our border.
This year was going to be our third trip down there, and we were getting excited for it. We invited some friends of ours to come along with us. We're going to make a whole thing of it, go for about a week and a half. And all that changed after the election.
It's not just politics. They're worried for their safety. Next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
We have just come off of the state holiday honoring Prince Kuhio Kalanianiʻole and his part in creating the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. HWARE's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel attended an event on Molokai recently celebrating the history of the homestead program. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so our listeners may not know that the first, early pilot was actually there on Molokai.
It was. The first Hawaiian homestead settlement was in Kalamaʻula, Molokai. And after the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act was passed in 1921, of course, which Prince Kuhio was essential in passing, the first homestead was begun in 1922 on Molokai. It was known as the Kalanianiʻole Settlement. And the event that I just went to last weekend was actually celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Ho'olehua Pala'au homesteads, which were started just a couple years afterward. They were the third homestead community in Hawaii, the first being Kalamaʻula, the second being on Hawaii Island, and then the third was in Ho'olehua, which is still thriving. You know, those homestead communities are still thriving today. And homesteaders came to Molokai from across Hawaii. Molokai Kupuna Opuʻulani Albino, her great-grandfather was from Waikapu on Maui, and he and their family from there was known for their success in farming, really living off the land, hunting, and so her family now has seven generations on Molokai from that first, their first family members that came over from Maui. She shared the history of those early homesteads on Molokai.
July of 1922, the first homesteaders moved to that Kalanianiʻole. They had 22 farm lots, 33 residential lots that were all in development. So in 1924, in Kalanianiʻole, it became so, you know, productive that it became known as Molokai Miracle. But by 1930, the same fields became unproductive because of the high saline content of the water pumped from the wells of Kalamaʻula. So in 1924, the decision made was to look for another tract of land for homesteading, and that was when the Central Plains of Ho'olehua came into consideration. And that's when the main group of farmers came, you know, in 1924. So original 75 came during 1924 to 1926. There were 75 of them.
I like that concept of Molokai Miracle.
Yeah, like she said, it was, you know, it blossomed. But they had huge challenges to overcome. You know, even in those early days, living on Molokai was really difficult. They struggled with a lack of water, as Antiopuulani mentioned. It turned brackish. The land was really barren from cattle ranching during that time. You know, it was a period in which, settlers were coming in and bringing their ranching. There were really strong winds that were blowing that made it really inhospitable. And along with that, some of these early homesteaders who came to Molokai were not welcomed by, you know, the folks who were living on Molokai at that time. Even though, you know, they were Hawaiians, they were coming from different communities. And so just adjusting, making those changes to starting from absolutely nothing, you know, was really challenging. And the success of the early Molokai homesteads really determined whether the rest of the program across Hawaii would continue. You know, these were the pilot programs, those early first tests, whether they could live off the land, whether they could make it work. And so there was a lot resting on the success of these homesteads. Antiopuulani talked about the struggle to live without water in the area and what they did to help with that issue.
You know, it was either live or die, because if those crops were not planted and shown to be productive in a land without water, there was no infrastructure at the time. So this man, this kupuna, Mr. Palpala, would get his big old truck, and he and his wife would go get water from Kalakakai, drive all the way up to Holihua, to each home to deliver drinking water. So this is some of the activities they did in order to come together. So one of the miracles that I believe was performed by these pioneer elders to solve, you know, the problems, when the water had turned sour, some of the people died. The elders got together and they prayed. And then they found from the people who lived here of Molokai's own natives that the land at a certain place where heiau was, it was cursed because of the ancient cultural activities of the people that lived in that area. So the rain was baked or heated so that the clouds would not produce rain because of an oven that is located in Naiva, Ka'umu Kalua'ua. They realized that they had to use the most powerful tool they had, was a spiritual tool, and that was to pray and ask God to lift the curse from Ka'imu Kalua'ua. And this they did. They fasted for 3 days. This is in a journal from Edward Kuomu Maka'iwi, who was the youngest of the Maka'iwi sons. They literally walked the rain back to Holihua. So for 3 days and nights, the rains fell. And from this time forward, all of their crops, especially before the visit of Governor Farrington and his wife, you know, they were abundant and they grew well, and literally water came out of the ground.
Yeah, interesting story.
For sure. And her ohana is the Maka'iwi ohana that she mentioned in what she just shared. So her ohana was tied to those early days, and, you know, she's many generations now living on Molokai. Kilia Purdy Avalino is another Ho'olehua homesteader whose ohana, her tutu, was from Waimea on Hawaii Island, and was one of the first Ho'olehua homesteaders. And Kilia's ohana is now 6 generations here, still living on homestead land. Her grandmother wrote articles in the Hawaiian newspaper about early homesteading. And so a lot of these things were very well documented, you know, in journals or newspapers. And so Kilia's tutu was one of the first to get her lease in Ho'olehua in October 1924. And, you know, Kilia talked about Prince Kuhio's legacy and how important it is to continue to honor him today for all he did, really being instrumental in, you know, the survival of Hawaiians. And for Kilia Purdy Avalino, you know, she said continuing to work on the land is one of the best ways to mahalo him.
You know, look at what my tutu said, a land of milk and honey, and It really is. And of course, we go through challenges like anybody else. But the best thing we can do is keep putting our hands to the soil, keep growing food, keep planting, you know, and if we can make our own economic base off of our homesteads, I feel like that's what Kuhio's vision was. But it wasn't just about living in a home. It was about putting your hands in the soil and rehabilitating us as a people. Like the aina is what makes us who we are as Hawaiians. And he saw the detachment of that, and which is why he wanted us to be back and to assure that we had land.
Yeah, you know, it is just such interesting history.
It is. And Enteo Pu'ulani talked about how as Prince Kohio went to Congress and was fighting, you know, for the passage of the Hawaiian Homes Act, Hawaiians were being taken away from their land and were dying in large numbers. And she said, you know, that reflected that strong connection between the aina and the Hawaiian people. She said, you take a Hawaiian off the land and you're going to kill them, because that's, you know, what fed them. And so keeping that connection alive, you know, today is really important to homesteaders still.
Well, thank you for highlighting this bit of history for us, Catherine. It helps us appreciate, you know, when we think of Prince Kohio and the holiday.
For sure. Thank you.
That was HVR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel taking us to Molokai to reflect on the early history of the Hawaiian Homesteading Program.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for over 85 years committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Conspiracy theorists believe more than $400 billion of gold at Fort Knox is missing. President Trump is pumping up those conspiracies when he says,
"We're going to go to Fort Knox, the fabled Fort Knox, to make sure the gold is there."
Well, it is there, and so is the very real economic uncertainty that's sending gold prices stratospheric. We'll talk about America's gold obsession. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from PAR Hawaii, committed to meeting the energy needs of Hawaii and supporting community nonprofit organizations across the islands. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
Today, we revisit a story we aired last spring featuring the globally syndicated program By Design TV. There is Europe By Design, America By Design, Australia By Design. The series air on the CBS network and on streaming platforms. The production crew was in the islands last spring filming for the second season of America By Design. Take a listen to a clip from the episode, which premiered in November. In it, host and producer Mike Chapman learns about the history of the home from Christy Cardoso, the executive director of the Lillestrand Foundation.
I'm in the hills above Honolulu, heading for Lillestrand House. When it was designed, Hawaii had turned from an agriculture economy to a military one, and planes were getting faster, so tourism was booming. All this was an influence. Christy.
Mike, welcome to Lillestrand House.
Thank you.
The house was designed by architect Vladimir Osipov and built for Howard and Betty Lillestrand in 1952.
And I understand it's the best example of an Osipov designed house that you can walk through.
Yes, it is. We are now a historic house museum.
So nobody lives here anymore.
Correct. But Bob Lillestrand, the eldest son of the family who grew up in the house,
who's also an architect?
Yes, correct. He often said that architecture is the product of the time, the place, and the people who made it. So come on in and let's go back to 1952.
Yeah, we caught up with the By Design production team at the Mid-Century Modern Tenless Hideaway. Here's a peek behind the scenes that we captured. Chapman learns about the Lillestrand House's place in Hawaii from Cheryl Seaman, the principal of council at G70 Design.
And action. Cheryl, Christy was telling me about the Japanese tradesmen and craftsmen. I'm not sure I'm seeing it in the architecture, though.
Well, take a look at how these mullions line up with the beautiful way they cast the shadow, how being a little thicker than the framing of the window itself. And then, of course, for instance, how these details are done. See how this the header is led into the vertical so that basically you don't really require mechanical fasteners. It holds itself together. And take a look at these bookshelves. See the shelves are okay. Led into the
that's
vertical.
Beautiful. Look at that
similarly.
Beautiful work, yeah.
Isn't it beautiful? And again, it allows the wood to move naturally with the climate.
Yeah.
And the wood, even when it's built into a house, is a living thing. It's still moving and changing its form with the weather. Take a look at this old desk. This beautiful antique from China. You know, the Lillestrands were from China originally.
Yes, that was another part of their story.
Yeah, it's a big part of their story. And if you look around the house, you'll see many Chinese and other Asian antiques that they collected over their time and travels. And compared, sitting right next to this Eames chair, which was, at the time the house was built, a fairly new piece.
Yeah.
And it was a classic design, and it's still being made by Miller Knoll, for instance, and all of those classic designers are still very sought after today.
Yeah, I mean, they were the big noise of the 50s, weren't they, in furniture design.
But it's still good today and still in production. And furthermore, you know, they last forever.
Yeah. You know what, Cheryl? I've got an Eames. And this one from the 50s looks just as comfortable in this setting as mine does in my modern apartment.
Yeah, of course. That's what good design is, timeless.
Good design is timeless. Chapman hit on that idea, and the show speaks volumes about the effort and thought behind good design, not just in your backyard, but across the globe. From Tasmania to Tenless, Chapman is a driving force behind the By Design brand. Chapman sets the stage.
So we have America By Design, architecture, America By Design innovations. We have Australia By Design, which is why I sound like I do, because we started there. Hotels By Design is another whole series as well. With each one of them, we like to dive into the weeds of the design process behind the project. We're on CBS mostly in America, Channel 10 in Australia as well. One of the guys at CBS once said to me, we're one of the smarter programs on CBS. And I like that. I like that comment because, you know, TV's really mistreated the topic of design. You know the show. I'm going to describe about 20 different shows here. The design guy flounces in with his colorful scarf and changes the colors on the wall and rearranges the furniture. And, you know, and that's the designer. But, you know, I think we could do better than that. And so with our show, with By Design, we're having a smarter conversation, but an accessible conversation to the general public. So it's still popular TV, you know, it's CBS, it's the football crowd, if you will. But there's such a misunderstanding about what designers do, what architects do. And I guess we're trying to fix that. It's water crashing up against the rocks. It's a big job. But we're doing what we can.
So what is it about the design here in Hawaii? I mean, we happen to be here at the Lillestrand House. And what are you struck by when you come to a place like this?
Yeah, oh my God, I am struck by this place. This is unusual, actually, as a story for us. We're in Hawaii doing a number of stories across those brands. So this is an architecture story here at Lillestrand. Usually we're not so historical. You know, generally we look at new projects that are just complete. But oh boy, I love this. When I do another interview like this with someone else and they say, what was your favorite project in the last, because we're going to travel the world, I'm totally going to lock this in as one that I'll mention.
You were also over at Iolani School. You were over at the Prince Hotel. You know, I mean, those are all for the architecture piece.
Yeah, we tend to come, when we come to a place, we gather a number of stories. So the Prince Waikiki, that's for our hotel brand. That's another series we do, Hotels by Design. That's perhaps our most popular. For all intents and purposes, it looks like a travel show. But the focus is, it's through the lens of design. So Marie Kim, the design architect on that project, you know, we walk around with her talking about the intent. That has a very special story, such a deep research behind that. The stream that used to flow through that site before the hotel was there and previous buildings before that, they've used that as a reference, you know, and I love that. I love that kind of story. We were in another story with Mana Ola. I know he's a popular figure here. We spent a day with him. That was for an innovation story on how he's bringing Hawaiian culture through his design, through his fashion, to a worldwide audience. I learned a lot about aloha. I thought aloha was hello. It's way more than that, you know, and Mana Ola set me straight on that. So that's fantastic. And we this ends up in front of people sitting in their lounge rooms in New York. You know, I think we're doing some good there. You know, before I started making this show, I'm like most Americans, most Australians, they don't necessarily know what industrial design is. What's that? You're designing factories? And the industrial design community play out that conversation at every barbecue. They, you know, what do you do for a living? So the IDSA, Industrial Designers Society of America, love us. You know, they love that we're doing their job for them, you know. And just getting out the word about what industrial design is, that's helpful. It's helpful too for, I'm very aware, this is a big responsibility on me as the producer. We end up in people's lounge rooms. And so the faces that we choose to put on the screen are very influential. So I do my best. I mean, we're not where we all want to be. So it's actually harder. If I just wanted to put middle-aged white guys on TV, it would be a much easier show, you know, but but to advance the plot, you know, I want a 16-year-old young woman in Chicago to sit there and go, oh wow, this is what I want to do. I've finally worked it out. And probably more important, or as important is that their parents can get that it's actually a pathway, it's a real thing, you know, industrial design. Oh my God, I thought they wanted to be a struggling artist on the street, but no. What she actually is talking about is being a designer. So that responsibility I take on my shoulders while producing this show, it's really important.
I guess of the places that you've been and you know, the different things that you've looked at, I mean, is there anything that you're particularly struck by here in Hawaii and the islands as you've gone place to place to shoot these episodes?
Yeah, this is a spiritual place, Hawaii. It's a little bit different than filming in Vegas, you know? I mean, that Mana Ola story, I mean, I was moved to tears filming, just getting a cultural lesson pretty much on, I mean, I felt, I'm an Australian boy, I felt like I know, I have a big relationship with the islands, you know, mainly the South Pacific Islands, filmed a lot there. And I'm also very aware of Indigenous culture and the struggles going on. What Mana Ola is doing is not just for Hawaiians, that's for Indigenous cultures generally. They can learn a lot from what he's doing. I love that. Circling back around to Lily Strand here, meanwhile, that's just another really amazing place. You know, Hawaii is more than, you know, Mai Tais and the usual images that we're all can summon up in 5 seconds. I guess what I'm hoping I can tell the rest of America, the rest of the world, because our show does travel with streaming, etc., everywhere, is the backstory, you know, the extra story. For those who want to listen, you know, the smarter, I don't know, top half. But if we can make that top half maybe the top 70% instead of the top 50%, just in my little corner of the world, that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. And then I understand that you tapped Mari as well. I mean, she was an architect, and you were using her as the architect, but then she's also helping to host some shows.
No, our cast are mostly made up of real live architects. Oh my goodness, Marie Kim, I love, love, love her. What a powerhouse she is. So as apart from giving us connections within Hawaii, homeland, and elsewhere, Oh, we're also doing a story on Bihari, by the way, which is the Brain Institute that Mari Kim and some others are creating here in Hawaii. Boy, that's going to be an interesting story. That's going to really test my storytelling skills because it's so complex what's going on there, but so amazing. But all our cast are architects, industrial designers. I mean, we'll take a hit on the performance if we have to. We're more interested in the credibility, the passion for design. That comes through, and we, I think people notice that. TV's usual approach is to perhaps get the ex-weather person with the chiseled chin and the high social media numbers and give them some design things to say. but no, let's get the right people, the authentic people. And the design community have really recognized that, and they've got behind us.
Yeah. So it's really kind of the authenticity, really, that you're after, not the flash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in this fast world, there's so much flash. You know, but there's still a handful of us out there, maybe your listeners, who are looking for authenticity, you know, and looking for the real stories, looking for the slightly longer story form. We still want that.
That was Mike Chapman, producer and host of By Design TV. We talked to him last spring as the production was winding down on 9 days of shooting. And again, we learned about the show thanks to Hawaii architect Mari Kim, who has been featured as a co-host on the By Design series. We'll have a link on our website to the episode from Season 2 of America by Design featuring the Lillestrand House. It's a real treat.
On the next Fresh Air, Syria may be on the verge of a new era of unity, or it may descend into anarchy, and the outcome will affect the Middle East and the U.S. Syria's transitional president founded the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda, but he's now preaching inclusivity. We'll talk with Robert Worth of The Atlantic about his reporting. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Train robberies, it turns out, are still a thing.
They cut the locks off the containers, they unload what they want, and trucks come, pick it up, and they drive away.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the Modern Train Heist, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Festival that celebrates the history and culture of Lahaina comes to Honolulu tonight. The Hui Mo'olelo Film Festival brings together animated films that draw upon a series of oral histories recorded by the Lahaina community members after the 2023 Maui wildfires. The nonprofit Maui Public Art Corps is organizing the festival in partnership with the University of Hawaii at Manoa and Vai Vai Collective. Artists added their own flair to the animation by using music and sound effects. Take a listen to a part of the short film created around a story told by Theo Morrison, executive director of the Lahaina Restoration Foundation.
A friend of mine had sent me a photo of a Kurlikoa bench that was from Halealoha, and I was like, whoa. It was for sale in an antique store in Wailuku, which is where I happen to be. So I went over to look at it, and looking at the bench, I wasn't seeing a bench. I was seeing those stories. I was feeling those emotions that the people would have felt in those meetings. And I envisioned this bench, along with many others, being in that building. So I bought the bench, which is not something I normally would do, because of those stories. And I plan to donate it to Lahaina Restoration Foundation so they can put it in the Heritage Museum, which will be rebuilt at the old Lahaina Courthouse. So that's my story about the whole bench. Thank you.
And the conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with the Maui-based animator of that short film, Sasha Herchik. She also spoke with Kelly White, the manager of Maui County's public art program and who was the co-founder of Maui Public Art Corps. White starts us off.
Hui Mo'olelo is a program that kind of spawned from a partnership between three core entities. So that's County of Maui, Hale Ho'ike'ike at the Bailey House, Maui Historical Society, that's one organization, and Maui Public Art Corps. And we began a public art program specifically for the town of Wailuku on the island of Maui in 2018 that was named after the Wailuku town motto. The motto is Small Town Big Heart. So our public art program was Small Town Big Art. Right after the 2023 wildfires that wiped out Lahaina Town and that occurred in upcountry Maui, individuals and groups were reaching out to us saying, why aren't you bringing this storytelling project to Lahaina? Yeah, because at that point, we had already expanded to Koho'olawe, Lanai City, and Kahului. And rather than just saying, great, let's have a Lahaina cohort with the same exact team and same exact values and same research, we really needed to tap into the experts in Lahaina sense of place and history and culture. And so we worked really, really hard to form a new partnership with Lahaina Restoration Foundation. And their cultural director, Kalapana Kohlers, was so generous to lead our most recent Hui Mo'olelo cohort. And so Kalapana and his wife, Anuhea Yagi, handpicked all of the cohort members from Lahaina, who in turn selected their own intergenerational partners. So in years past, we helped set up those pairings, but with Lahaina, the folks really wanted to choose their own partners, which was really beautiful. And then Sasha came to the picture when we released the RFP and had a whole group of community panelists sit down and determine which artists would be selected not only for this animation film festival, but for other public art projects throughout Lahaina.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect place for Sasha to come in. And I'd love if you could start with a bit about your background as an artist.
Sure. So I was raised on Maui. I moved here when I was very young, around like 10 years old, and finished all of my school years here, graduated from St. Anthony in Wailuku, and stayed on island for a little bit until a couple of years went by. And then I decided I wanted to go to art school so that I could learn how to be an animator, because it was just something that I was really passionate about. So I went to Chicago and moved home as soon as I finished because it was really, really cold. And I missed Maui. And so I've been doing freelance ever since I moved back, since 2017, mainly doing animation work and design work for companies that were not Maui-based, so all remote work. And eventually was just sort of feeling like there was like a lack of fulfillment in what I was doing, and I really wanted to find a way to connect with the Maui art community and like use my skill set to give back in some way. And it's like some sort of manifestation power. Like as soon as I started thinking about that, that's when I ended up finding an open call from Maui Public Art Corps in 2022, I think it was.
I want to talk a little bit more about the process of animating. And then I'm also really struck by your talking about fulfillment and the idea of doing something meaningful that relates to the community that you've been a part of, grown up and moved back to. And I can imagine this project would have felt especially fulfilling, but I wondered, what were the pressures? Did you feel kind of a really high level to do some of these stories justice?
Oh, absolutely. You have this awful tragedy that happened to our home and all of these people who were directly affected by it. And most of those people are the ones that are giving us their story, which alone already is very painful to have them share this with us. Some people still can't right now, because of dealing with that trauma. It's very intense, right? And then the idea that we're listening to this audio, to this narration that's been shared with us from people that are going through this very difficult time, and then having the responsibility to make something beautiful out of it was very sensitive. And I really wanted to do to do these stories justice. And I remember initially when the fires happened, there was this moment that happened, especially with a lot of artists, a lot of local artists. They were making prints and t-shirts and stickers and all this stuff. And usually it was like, you know, they came up with this design and are trying to use it for fundraising and awareness and crowdsourcing and all of this stuff. And I remember my creativity like froze in that moment. Like I didn't have the ability to make something. And I just remember actually talking to my mom. My mom was like, have you made anything? Have you made anything for Lahaina? Like what's going on? And I'm like, I couldn't do anything. It was just one of those moments where it was just stunted because I was still processing what was happening. But I had this sensation that it would happen in its own time. I knew I wanted to make something, a film, an animation, something when this first happened. And then the Lahaina Mo'olelo project ended up releasing and I was like, there it is, perfect. Okay, great. Because as a solo artist, this was also something I was trying to explain to like people close to me when they were asking me like, why didn't I just do something independently? And it's not the amount of people that it's reaching, it's the people themselves that it's reaching, if that makes any sense. So it wasn't like I wanted to make something and have it go out into the world and just like be so be it. Whoever sees it, sees it. It was more like I wanted the right people to see this.
Sasha, you produced three animations of different stories. I'd love if you could pick one and walk us through the process and then some of the creative decisions you were making along the way to bring those stories to visual life.
Sure. A somewhat easier one to think about process-wise is the Johto Mission one. And it's kind of cool because all three animation teams decided to animate that one. And in the beginning, I think all three of us were like, oh, dang, okay, all right, are we all going to do the same thing? But it was amazing how we did something completely different. And I just think that in itself already is like, you know, just so telling as far as what each artist takes out of something that's identical, you know, which is just very, very cool. The UH Manoa team, they did like a really cool, almost like a day in the life of Johto Mission, which I thought was really pretty. And then I remember Richard O'Connor did kind of like this amazing amalgamation of all the different interviews that he had and like layered Johto Mission in there. But for me, I took just the excerpt that Reverend Hara read this magazine excerpt from, I think it was like the 60s. And he was very passionate about wanting to read it. And I liked it because when he reads it in Japanese, but when you read the transcript, it was very storytelling, which was really nice. It had like a beginning, a middle, and an end. So it was just this very beautiful journalistic style of storytelling. And so that really captivated me. I liked it a lot. And I went into this project with the idea of preservationist art. I remember the very first time I went to the Bailey House Museum, there was a bunch of paintings up. And that was where I first learned about preservationist art, is there were painters back in the day that would paint things exactly as they saw them because it was in order to preserve the space. And that was my thought going into this, is I wanted to almost make it like preservationist paintings that were moving. And so it was difficult because, again, we couldn't really go to the location. And even if we did, the things that I wanted to showcase were no longer there. So I ended up using a lot of photos off of their website. And strangely enough, Google Maps was like the savior because you ended up, you know, doing the 3D thing and you could just move around and like got a real sense of place and location and where things were. So I grabbed as many like iconic scenes as I could think of, because you go onto Google and they have all of these photos that people were taking. And it was almost like people were taking the same pictures, even though it was a gajillion different people. So I was like, okay, so there are some specific shots that people really enjoyed and really liked when they went to Johto Mission. So I just really focused on those, and then also tried to make it feel like you were almost walking through the Johto Mission and like taking a picture, walking through and taking a picture. So that was the idea that I was going with. And at the very end, So the story he talks about is this journalist who's visiting Johto Mission and is like, this is really beautiful, and he's describing everything. And then eventually he describes Reverend Hara and his wife and then sitting down in the back and like eating mango mousse and by the waves and listening to everybody talk and just having like a beautiful sentimental moment. So I had the idea of walking through Johto Mission and taking snapshots and then being that person who is sitting down and eating his mango mousse and, you know, listening to the waves. And so that was kind of how I went through that. And then we had the talk with Reverend Hara and Yayoi, his daughter. We had a big Zoom meeting with all of them and all of the animators where we just kind of picked their brains a little bit. And that was what sort of solidified that for me, because you could tell that they obviously really missed their space.
That's a great place to bring in the film festival, the upcoming one, and also the one that already took place. And so, Kelly, how did that partnership with UH come about, and also the decision to show some of these films on Oahu?
Yeah, it's a big, happy surprise that we've been invited to come to Honolulu. It came as a result of the community engagement process with the UH Manoa team. There's four student artists that our panelists selected to interpret the story of Yayoi Hara and her father, Reverend Hara. Actually, it's a really nice story. Yayoi's father, Reverend Hara, a couple weeks after we had our community consultation with him on Zoom, asked if he could share a poem that he had recorded. And we shared that with UH, and the dancers in their dance department there decided to create some improv dance to the poem while our artists, our animation artists and their drawing companions did gesture drawing and life drawing. And the outreach department of the university got wind of us coming over and doing some work together and asked if it would be possible for us to bring the entire film fest to Honolulu. And we said, holy moly, yes. If you can find us a place to do this and you can sponsor it, because I can't use any of my grant funds to produce artworks in a different county, right? All of my funds are really place-based. And UH and Vaivai have very generously offered to sponsor the entire thing.
And then sometime afterwards, these animations will be released online.
It's gonna have to be the next day, Maddie, because we keep getting asked. There's definitely a demand because we sold out, quote unquote, Pro Arts in Kihei 2 days in a row, and unfortunately had to turn people away, which was an exciting moment for us, but really sad to, you know, have to turn people away. And because the nature of this work is public art, it also kind of crushed us a little bit to not release these films immediately, but specifically to give those UH students their moment and, right, to have the unveiling with their friends and family. We asked if we could just wait a couple more weeks, and then we'll post everything to mauipublicart.org/filmfest on the 28th of March.
That was Kelly White and Sasha Herchik talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. The Hui Mo'olelo Lahaina Film Festival takes place this evening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Vaivai Collective. A few tickets still remain for the free event, and we'll have a link on our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to broadcast from Kona as the conversation goes on the road. We'll feature a couple of segments that we taped before a live audience at the Kahilu Theater last week. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.